Iran strongly condemns Israel's massacre of civilians in Gaza as barbaric, saying the US and the EU must be ashamed of supporting the regime's genocide. The UN rights chief warns Israel's ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah would incur potentially massive loss of life on people sheltering there. A Yemen's Ansarullah leader says the country's army has successfully managed to bar all Israel-linked vessels from crossing the Red Sea. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. Now Israel continues to massacre Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. In the latest attack, regime forces shot at starving people waiting for food aid in northern Gaza. At least 112 Palestinians were killed and more than 700 injured. We discuss the latest developments in our news review program.
The scenes of horrific killing of Palestinians have become common ever since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. The regime forces have massacred scores more Gazans who were waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 112 people were killed after Israeli snipers shot directly at a crowd waiting for aid in the early morning. Hundreds more sustained injuries. The dead and wounded have been taken to Al-Shifa and Kamal Adwan hospitals. Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned the attack, saying that it was a cold-blooded massacre. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have also censured the massacre of Gazans. Palestinians are already struggling with shortages of food, as the Israeli regime is using starvation as a weapon against them. Shortages have caused a surge in malnutrition among children, with the UN warning of a looming famine. The Israeli genocide has so far killed over 30,100 Gazans. Rick Sterling is an investigative journalist joining us from Walnut Creek in California. We also have Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, joining us from Saidiya over in Morocco. Welcome to you both. Rick Sterling, I'll start with you. There's a couple real shocking, not that before we didn't hear shocking news coming out of the Gaza Strip. One of them is the fact that you have people in one particular incident that's now been broadcast that are eating cactus for food. The other is the massacre that took place where the military aid convoy comes, not the military, but the aid convoy comes, Palestinians line up for food, and then they get shot at by the regime forces, and they killed over 100. These are gross violations, this particular one, the massacre, that's a genocide that's taking place, and it's a war crime. We're still looking at this happening. What do you make of the fact that this is still continuing by the Israeli regime?
Well, I think Israel is spitting in the face of the International Court of Justice, which ruled at the end of January that Israel should stop this, and they're just continuing as before. They've prevented food and drinking water and medications to come into Gaza. They've severely restricted it. They've tried to get all of the people out of northern Gaza, to flush them into southern Gaza and Rafah. Israel has bombed the bakeries, and now when the starving people are congregating trying to get food, the Israeli tanks and soldiers have fired on the civilians lining up to try to get food. So it's just another continuation of the genocide.
Taking a look at the way that this genocide has continued, Kevin Barrett, it would not happen were it not for the U.S. support militarily to the Israeli regime. We had at one point where a Pentagon spokesperson has said that Israel has unfettered access to military equipment of all kinds, bombs, you name it. That's happening almost on a daily basis, if not on a daily basis. So doesn't that make the U.S. as guilty?
Yes, 100%. Chris ought to be right up there on the defendant's stand with the Israeli leaders, and they all need to be tried, convicted, in many cases executed. These are among the worst war criminals in history. There's no reason that this has to happen. You know, there are wars that are driven by actual necessity. This is not. This is basically an act of pure aggression by these Zionist genocidal maniacs who have a crazy fundamentalist religious view. It's actually not even an authentic traditional religious view, but it's a satanic spin-off of a millenarian messianic kind of lunacy that's been percolating in that community for hundreds of years now, and it's turned into to sheer genocide driven by utter madness. There's no military purpose to luring people, to starving them until they show up in the thousands to try to get a sack of flour, and then firing into the crowd with tanks, which is what just happened, killing over 100 people and wounding many, many hundreds more.
Let me thank Rick Sterling, investigative journalist there from Walnut Creek, California, and also Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, spoke to us from Saidiya over in Morocco. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review.
Condemnations are pouring in from across the globe following the Israeli massacre of over 100 Palestinians who were waiting for life-saving humanitarian aid in northern Gaza. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman described the attack on the defenseless civilians as barbaric. Nasser Kanani said the shame of supporting and remaining silent towards the Israeli genocide will remain with the false champions of human rights in the US and Europe. Meanwhile, the UN aid chief expressed shock at the incident. Martin Griffiths said he was appalled at the killing of hundreds of people during the transfer of aid supplies in Gaza. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also denounced the deadly attack.
The Secretary General condemns the incident today in northern Gaza, in which more than 100 people were reportedly killed or injured while seeking life-saving aid.
Turkey has also condemned the massacre. The Turkish Foreign Ministry said it proves Israel seeks to consciously and collectively destroy the Palestinian people. The Colombian president said the attack is genocide, even if the world powers don't like to recognize it as such. Gustavo Petro added that his country suspends all purchases of weapons from Israel. Canada's Foreign Minister Melanie Joly also described Israel's massacre of Palestinians in Gaza as a nightmare. Spain condemned the Gaza massacre as unacceptable, while France called it unjustified. A draft proposal has been released as a result of extensive talks in Paris over a potential ceasefire in Gaza. One of the conditions exclusively prevents displaced men of military service age from returning to their homes in northern Gaza. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabbe has talked to some of the Palestinians in Deir al-Balah about the ceasefire conditions.
This proposal is null and meaningless to me. I'm married and have kids. I can't let them go back to Gaza while I'm still here. We prefer to die here rather than accepting this proposal. We demand a permanent ceasefire that guarantees our full return to our residential areas in Gaza. Undoubtedly, it's another pressure exerted on the Palestinian resistance.
This is another pressure practice against us. They know that the displaced families are not going to accept it. No one accepts to abandon the rest of his family and go back without them. They propose it just to blackmail us. I won't accept going back to Gaza without my husband. And my mother won't accept that return without my brothers. We fled our homes in Gaza together, and we will return together.
It's impossible to accept such a thing. Our men raise our kids day by day until they grow up. We spent these horrific days worrying about our children and young men. We escaped the killing in Gaza to protect them. We can't leave them and get back. We live together or we die together. No one would accept it. It's unnegotiable. We are still steadfast until we go back in dignity.
It's definitely rejected. We have been displaced from Gaza for the sake of our children's safety. They killed thousands of our children and our men, and they destroyed our homes and buildings. But now they propose us to go back without our sons and men. No rational human being would agree on this. This proposal means that Israel is procrastinating, and it dogs having a real deal. Netanyahu is a war criminal, and he wants to prolong this war against us.
Firstly, this proposal is completely rejected. It's a continuation of the expulsion that took place at the beginning of this war in Gaza. They want to separate the families and increase their suffering. They want the women and children to go to Gaza while keeping the men here so they can target them at any moment under any pretext. This is another way that Israeli occupation procrastinates putting the ceasefire deal in place in order to continue its genocide in Gaza.
The UN Human Rights Chief has once again issued a stark warning against Israel's planned ground assault on the southern Gaza city of Rafah.
A ground assault would incur potentially massive loss of life, additional risk of atrocity crimes, new displacement to another unsafe location distribution, and sign a death warrant for any hope of effective humanitarian aid. For my part, I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures that were issued by the International Court of Justice.
Turk told the UN Human Rights Council that an attack on Rafah would take the nightmare that is being inflicted on Gazans to a new dimension. He slammed the regime's attacks and killings in Gaza as examples of Israel's brutality and carnage. Turk stressed that there are no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding in Gaza. Rafah is the territory's most populated area, where over 1.5 million people are sheltering. They have nowhere safe to go, and many of them have already been displaced multiple times. Over 30 international media outlets have expressed solidarity with journalists working in the war-ravaged Gaza Strip, calling for their protection and freedom to report. The call came in an open letter coordinated by the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists. It was signed by leading global news agencies and newspapers. The letter said, for nearly 5 months, journals in Gaza have been working in unprecedented conditions. It added that journalists are civilians and Israel must protect them as non-combatants according to international law. The regime has been deliberately and systematically targeting journalists and other media staff since the beginning of its Gaza genocide early last October. Over 130 journalists have lost their lives since then. Israeli forces have killed two unarmed Palestinian youths and injured another in the occupied West Bank. All three victims were brothers and under the age of 30. They were gathering herbs near the town of Beit Awa, southwest of the city of Al-Khalil, when attacked by Israeli occupation forces. The Palestinian Health Ministry said Najm al-Din al-Shawamra was killed on the spot after being shot in the heart. His brother, Salah ad-Din, was seriously injured and later died at hospital. The third brother was shot in the abdomen, but his injuries have been described as minor. Meanwhile, a Palestinian man who was critically injured by Israeli forces' live fire 5 months ago succumbed to his injuries. More than 400 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank since Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip started on October the 7th. The Lebanese resistance movement has conducted yet another operation on Israel in response to the regime's attacks along Lebanon's southern border. Hezbollah says it has targeted an Israeli military position in the occupied Lebanese Sheba Farms. The group has also launched another operation targeting a gathering of Israeli soldiers with missiles. The operation inflicted direct losses on the Israeli forces. The Lebanese resistance movement also targeted the cities of Eilon and Haifa in the occupied territories. Meanwhile, the Israeli artilleries targeted the town of Nakoura in southern Lebanon. The regime's drone also fell on the outskirts of Lebanese town of Labuna. Clashes between Hezbollah and Israel have been raised since October the 7th. That's when Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza. The leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement says the Yemeni armed forces have managed to successfully stop the movement of all Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait.
With God's help, our operations in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza, in light of these grave injustices in confronting the enemy, have reached the level of targeting 54 ships. This is a very important number. It is also a very large number. As we said in all the previous speeches, with God's help and with God's support, we achieved the goal of preventing the Israeli enemy from moving in Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea. whereby its commercial maritime movement, a lot of this movement relied on this passageway. But this has been obstructed to a large degree. It might also have been obstructed completely.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the US and the UK have failed to limit Yemeni operations and are surprised of Sana'a's capabilities. He reiterated that Yemen will continue its military operations in the Red Sea until Israel stops its onslaught on Gaza and ends the siege on the Palestinian territory. The Yemeni leader also slammed the US large-scale support for Israel's genocidal war. He noted that a US soldier self-immolating reflects the depth of resentment and public anger against Washington. Houthi stated that Israel and its allies want to eliminate Palestine altogether. In Iran, candidates vying for seats in parliament and the assembly of experts have wrapped up their election campaigns. Millions of Iranians will be heading to the polls on Friday to cast their ballots for the 290-member parliament and the 88-seat assembly of experts. Iran's interior ministry says over 15,000 candidates are competing in the parliamentary elections this year, a record since the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979. The Iranian legislative body called Majlis is elected for a four-year term. Hundreds of candidates are also in the fray for the Assembly of Experts, a deliberative body elected for 8 years. In a speech, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for massive voter turnout for the elections, which he described as a main pillar of the Islamic Republic. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kHz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
In the United States, a former FBI informant, Alexander Smirnov, has been charged with lying to the FBI about President Biden and his son, Hunter. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Alexander Smirnov, the former FBI informant charged with lying to the FBI about President Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden, was remanded to custody on Monday, 26th of February, pending a trial. Appearing in court on Monday, 26th of February, Smirnov said very little except answering yes when asked if he understood the case against him. He entered a plea of not guilty to the counts against him. Alexander Smirnov was arrested earlier this month on charges that he concocted fabrications about the president and his son accepting $5 million in bribes from the Ukrainian energy giant Burisma, which Republicans in Congress have repeatedly cited as a driving force in their efforts to impeach President Joe Biden. After being released by the court following his arrest, he was then rearrested last week and held in custody. U.S. District Judge Otis Wright had ordered Smirnov to appear in court on Monday, 26th of February, as the judge considered keeping Smirnov detained. Special Counsel David Weiss had asked the judge for Smirnov to be held until his trial date. His attorneys made a plea on Monday for his release, arguing that he has never committed a crime, that he worked for the U.S. government, and that he has never been accused of lying before. Justice Department officials argued that he's a major flight risk, and the judge agreed with the Justice Department. There is nothing garden variety about this case, the judge said, ordering Smirnov held until his trial. In a court filing last week, Special Counsel David Weiss's office alleged Smirnov had high-level contacts with Russian intelligence officials, who they said were involved in passing a story to him about Hunter Biden. Smirnov's efforts to spread misinformation about a candidate of one of the two major political parties in the United States continues, the court filing stated. What this shows is that the misinformation he is spreading is not confined to 2020. He is actively peddling new lies that could impact U.S. elections after meeting with Russian intelligence officials last November. Last July, Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican senator from Iowa, took the unusual step of releasing the confidential FBI informant's unverified claim that years ago, the Biden family pushed the Ukrainian oligarch to pay them $10 million. The claim, which Democrats and the White House immediately denied, has since been cited by congressional Republicans in part to justify their impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden. American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered the same story. Hunter Biden, President Biden's son, says his sobriety will be a key factor in his dad defeating Donald Trump in the 2024 election, telling the website Axios in a rare interview that he often thinks of the profound consequences the country may face if he lapses back into drug use, and news of it reached the American public. Maybe it's the ultimate test for a recovering addict. I don't know, he said. I have something much bigger than even myself at stake. We are in the middle of a fight for the future of democracy. He added that He's always been in awe of people who are able to maintain their sobriety amid profound tragedies and obstacles, saying those people are his heroes and inspiration. The troubled son of President Biden has become a punching bag for Republicans who've tried to tie his father, President Joe Biden, to his legal woes and struggles with substance abuse. Hunter Biden has been central to GOP lawmakers' ongoing impeachment probe into Joe Biden on allegations the senior Biden cut a deal with a Ukrainian energy company whilst in office. But a former FBI informant who made the accusations, Alexander Smirnov, was arrested this month on charges that he made the whole thing up at the behest of Russian intelligence officials. The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered the same story. A former FBI informant who is accused of lying to investigators about President Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden's business dealings was ordered detained pending trial in a Los Angeles court of law on Monday, 26th of February, just days after he was set free in Nevada. Alexander Smirnov was charged with two counts that amounted to allegedly making up fake stories about the Bidens, namely that they were each paid $5 million by a Ukrainian energy company, and passing that false information along to his FBI handlers for further investigation in 2020. Special Counsel David Weiss, the Donald Trump-appointed U.S. attorney who was elevated to continue his investigation into Hunter Biden, sought the indictment against him earlier this month. Last week, Alexander Smirnov, 43 years old, was briefly released from federal custody after a magistrate judge in Las Vegas, Nevada, said that certain conditions would permit his secure pre-trial freedom despite his alleged ties to foreign intelligence services that made him a flight risk. But on Thursday, Smirnov was taken back into federal custody and ordered to appear before the federal judge in Los Angeles, California, who will oversee his case, following a request from prosecutors to reconsider the release order. In court on Monday, 26th of February, prosecutors successfully argued that the judge should keep Smirnov detained, contending he cannot be trusted. Alexander Smirnov, who was wearing a jumpsuit and shackles, pleaded not guilty to both counts. There is nothing garden variety about this case, the judge said from the bench. I find no comfort in assurances you may offer that you will not flee the jurisdiction. In a notable move, Judge Otis Wright wrote in his initial order last week detaining Smirnov that defense attorneys were working to arrange the release of defendant Smirnov, likely to facilitate his absconding from the United States. The defense attorneys pushed back on those assertions, telling the judge he was wrong. Smirnov's lawyers opposed his detention and wrote last week that his personal relationships in the United States mitigated his risk of fleeing the country, and his lack of criminal history supported his release. When he was arrested for a second time, Mr. Smirnov was already free and working on his defense in his lawyer's office, his legal team wrote. This is hardly what you would expect of a person preparing to jump bail and flee the country. To the contrary, had he not been arrested, Mr. Smirnov would have voluntarily traveled to Los Angeles with his lawyers to attend the upcoming court hearing. During Monday's court hearing, his defense team pointed to Smirnov's longtime partner, who they said could serve as a third-party custodian. Prosecutors pushed back, saying she did not know they had about $3 million in their savings accounts and could not be trusted.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma once more. I have the honor to be your host in this program. And then we have Brother Mustafa with us to help us with the topics related to Muslim ladies. So, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam. Happy to be back for these episodes. You know,
thank you very much. Just for those people who have joined us recently, give us a very brief introduction about yourself.
Sure. I'm studying here in the Hawza, and I'm studying psychology as part of my studies. And I've been here for about 6 years.
Yeah. Brother Mustafa is an expert in psychology, and he knows about Islamic heritage and the narrations. So he's going to help us to look at Muslim ladies and their topics from the perspective of men. So speaking of the women as role models in the Holy Book of Quran, we come to see those examples in the life of the Prophet. Like one of them is Sayyida Khadija salamullah alayha, and also Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. These are the two very perfect examples of role models for all the Muslim ladies from all around the world. Like, we know the story of Sayyida Khadija, that she devoted all her life and all her wealth to the Prophet and his religion. She actually did more than her potential to save Islam and to help Prophet pave the road for the people to get involved and to get attracted to the religion of Islam. And this is so much for a woman to be done.
Definitely. And, you know, the two examples that you've mentioned, Sayyida Khadija and Sayyida Fatima, I feel like we can sort of, instead of like going to their stories and, you know, I feel like we can differentiate some of the roles that they've played, right? So one of the interesting things I find about Sayyida Khadija is that she was a successful and wealthy businesswoman of her time, right? Which seems kind of amazing in that Jahiliya era that she was able to do that. For example, we don't necessarily know her entire history.
In that dark ages, we do not expect a woman to be a businesswoman.
Now, did you notice that she also proposed to the Prophet?
Yeah.
Right? And one of the things she did before proposing to the Prophet, which is again is radical, that we have a woman proposing to not only a man, but the last Prophet, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that she did is she hired him as a merchant for her trade, and she sent one of her servants along with him, and she said, you know, along the way, I want you to observe like how he is, what he's doing, you know, how he's behaving. And throughout this sort of trip, you know, this servant was like sort of observing the Prophet, and then he came back and reported to her, and then she proposed to him, right? So she was looking for very specific character traits.
Mm-hmm.
And then she decided to marry, right? She wasn't like,
exactly.
You can see that.
She was a wise woman.
She was a wise woman. And again, that's an example for, I would say, today's woman is that, and men, that whoever you marry, find good positive traits in them, right? Don't just like think that it's all about looks and it's just about, you know, it's about superficial things. She was really someone who was wise and made a really wise decision,
mm-hmm.
right? When I say we differentiate between her and Sayyida Fatima, like we see that Sayyida Fatima wasn't like a businesswoman. We see that she had a much more different role, right? She's seen as the mother of our imams, right?
Exactly. And the protector of the first imam, because if she wasn't there, then the whole mission was not going to be done.
But what's common among both women is that they gave everything that they could to protect Islam, to help Islam, right? We see that, we know that Hazrat Khadija, she gave all of her wealth, you know, she gave...
And she was the first woman to join the Prophet in his religion.
Right, she was the first woman to join the religion.
All of these things are very much anti-cliché.
Definitely.
She's not like anyone else.
Anti-cliché even for Hazrat Fatima is that, you know, when she went to ask for Imam Ali's rights, right?
Exactly,
That again is a very, very great example. And we see that same example being reflected in her daughter, Hazrat Zainab, when she was in the court of Yazid, right?
So as the mother is the daughter.
I think these examples are unthinkable from that era, right? Many women, I would say today, Muslims, non-Muslims alike, are confused. They really think that they're being oppressed, right? And one of the unfortunate reasons for that is because of, I would say, propaganda or misunderstanding history or the verses of the Quran, right?
Yeah. And then, after the break, you're going to explain how.
Inshallah.
Welcome back. Well, this is Muslim Lady. You're still listening to Arab English Radio, and we're talking about women as role models, and the greatest one of them, like Sayyida Khadija and Sayyida Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayhim. So, you were talking about Sayyida Khadija, actually.
Right. I was speaking about both of them, right?
Both of them.
And I was sort of contrasting and showing what are some of the differences and similarities mm-hmm. in the roles that they've played. So one of the roles that's highlighted between both of them, I would say, is the role of the mother, right? I believe it's from one of the speeches of Ayatollah Khamenei. He mentions that, you know, Imam Ali, many times, in fact, I think it was like some like 75% of the time, he wouldn't be at home,
yeah.
right? He would be out on missions, he would be out on wars, he would be out doing things that the Prophet had asked him to do. So he says then, you know, who do you think then raised Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein? Right? It was obviously the mother that played that role. And that role is obviously emphasized in the Quran as well, you know, in different verses, the role of the mother. And I was saying before we went to the break, I was saying one of the issues today is that we have an incorrect understanding of those roles, right? People mm-hmm. have become confused about, or they'll see certain verses taken out of context, which make it appear as if, like, women are being oppressed,
yeah.
right? I would say it's important then for us to, if you have questions, then definitely question those things.
So what a Muslim lady is required is to go and search for everything that comes out of the Holy Book of Quran and do not take those words as literally.
Right, right. But one sort of practical technique I would offer to people is, which I had actually didn't even think about it, I came and learned that here, is that you can take specific words of the Quran, let's say you just take the word woman, and bring up all the verses which have woman in it. Right?
Yeah.
Take, for example, the word majnoon, crazy, and you'll see that it appears 11 times in the Quran. Right? Or you take the words hypocrite. When you put all of those verses together with the same words, you get a much, much better and clearer meaning of what God is trying to say there. Rather, because Quran is like a puzzle, right? God wants you to sit there and he tells you to yeah. think and ponder and fix and put that puzzle together.
You must decode them. They're yeah. all codes and signs, and you have to go for decoding and revealing the meaning behind those signs.
Right.
Sayyida Fatima, yes. salamullah alayha, and the role she had in the house as the mother to the imams of the Islamic heritage, of course, makes it clear for all the women out there that being a mother and just this name of a mother is not an easy responsibility. This is not to be taken as an oppression. Like if a woman is just a mother and she's doing the chores at home and taking care of the children and nurturing all those children, these are not easy tasks and responsibilities, and they should not be taken for granted.
Of course, and there's, you know, we have narrations where a woman who's weaning a child is, for example, compared to a warrior out in the, you know, a mujahid who's going and doing war.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I would also add, though, but for Lady Fatima, that's one of the main roles that she's played, but then we also see that she played a strong social role.
Yeah,
right?
Of course. Aside from being a perfect mother and a perfect wife, she had some social roles
right.
as well.
As Hazrat Khadija was a businesswoman, right? And the whole idea behind Islam is to support Islam, right? We're not saying you become a businesswoman to sort of just, you know, going buy the next
car. To be a model or to go for fashion or
just have riches.
Stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. We're seeing that here business is being utilized towards aiding Islam.
It's a tool.
It's a tool.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
In today's episode, we went through Sayyida Khadija and Sayyida Fatima, salamullah alayhim, and we also are going to mention some more of role models.
Right. So, for example, one of the women that show up in the Quran is Zulaykha, who
yeah.
was mentioned in Prophet Yusuf's story, right? And we see that she transforms from being someone who's a disbeliever, who's a pagan, who
is selfish.
And
she is totally synced in her own desires. But
she was very fashionable.
Yeah.
Right? She was very popular in her society.
And wealthy,
which is things that we see today as well, right, among women, is that they play the similar role that Zulaykha was playing back then, right? But then something happens which, you know, changes her, right?
A revolution.
A revolution takes place within her. And I would say the really amazing part about her is that the miracle that occurred with her, I think it hasn't occurred with any woman or person or man in sort of history, at least that we know about, right? We see that she becomes really old. The miracle I'm talking about is that her youth is restored. You know, God doesn't do that for anyone, but he does it for her.
For right? a woman.
She had pride and she had, you know, that status among society which got completely destroyed and lost.
After she fell in love with the Prophet. So as the reward for all the difficulties
right.
that she's been through, God renewed her youth, actually.
He restored her status. He restored
yeah.
her, you know, position back in society. So that, again, is a great example that, you know, in other words, you know, God says, you know, to all the servants, he says that, you know, no matter how much you've transgressed, you know, never lose hope because I'll forgive all your sins.
Exactly.
Right? And this, for me, this story of Zulaykha is a prime example of that. That she had the Prophet Yusuf imprisoned, you know, she had him tortured. She
mm-hmm.
did all sorts of things with him. But eventually God forgave all of that and restored everything that she lost.
Exactly.
Right? So for even as a man or a woman, I think it's a great example of how we shouldn't lose hope in God's mercy and how he forgives, you know,
yeah.
all
Once
all
you
sins.
Purify your soul, God is going to reward you. You said something that was very important. All these propagandas that are at work to tell us about oppression and the women's right, they forget to define these rights and what is equality. This equity that they come to talk about, what does it mean? You put it very much clear that the definition of rights and all of this equality must be justice, because through justice it is that everything is going to take its actual place in society, and that's what women are searching for, I suppose.
Right. And Islam, I would say, is a merit-based religion, right? It gives, you know, we're not saying that everyone is like completely equal, everyone should get the same thing. God is saying, no, the harder you work, the more you'll get.
Exactly.
Right? And that applies to both men and women. Whereas I would say in the West, I've lived in the West myself, I would say where their women are oppressed, right? They're having to fight for like all sorts of crazy things in that society. They're treated like an object in that society, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And you can see that clearly from movies and advertisements and TV shows, that women only really have one dimension to themselves many times, right? And that's not a very good, it's like a physical dimension that's
exactly.
always focused on. Whereas we're saying a woman has so many other dimensions, right? That she can be a pure servant of God, that she can be a businesswoman, that she can play social roles as a mother. So you can see how important all these roles are, that without them, society falls apart.
Exactly.
Right?
And that would actually give this insight to all the women out there to know about their rights, to know about the things that they must be after.
One last thing I want to say is that many times, I think our women don't even know what rights they have in Islam,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
So go and learn about these things. Go and educate yourselves and see what... I've recently learned some things that I didn't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's always room to learn and improve.
Yeah, and right. Thinking is the thing which is very much valuable, because through these thinkings, you're going to get closer to the real truth.
Right.
So thank you. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish. Election in view of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The 12th round of parliamentary election and the 6th round of the Assembly of Experts election will be held in Iran on March 1st, 2024. The Iranian people will go to ballot boxes to elect the candidates of the Islamic Council Assembly, called Majlis, and the Assembly of Experts. This will once more manifest the unity of the followers of various faiths, religious sects, and ethnicities in the vast Iranian land. The Islamic Council Assembly, Majlis, is one of the three branches of power according to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It is the main basis of legislature in the country, and the members of the Majlis are elected with the direct votes of people for a four-year term. The Assembly of Experts, however, is a unique body in Iran which has been shaped since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This organization has the duty of appointment of leader and supervision of the leader's performance. It can also dismiss the leader when needed. According to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, During the time of occultation of Imam Mahdi, the 12th infallible Imam from the Prophet's progeny, the country and the Islamic Ummah is led by a just and God-wary jurisprudent. He is aware of the circumstances of time, is brave, and a prudent administrator. Such a jurisprudent is elected by the assembly of experts, as they are specialized in finding the qualifications for the most important position in the country. The members of the Assembly of Experts are elected for an 8-year term. Among the most important reasons for election in the Islamic Republic of Iran, as a religious rule, are the emphasis of the Quran and the narrations from the Prophet and his 12 infallible successors, blessings of God upon them. God says in verse 11 of chapter Ra'd of the Noble Quran, "Indeed, Allah does not change a people's lot unless they change what is in their souls." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, also says, "No people consults except that is guided to the best way." In addition, Imam Ali, peace upon him, said that if there were not the big number of those who swear allegiance, he would abandon caliphate and rule of the Islamic Ummah. Moreover, Prophet has said elsewhere, "Whoever starts his day while he is indifferent towards the affairs of Muslims, he is not a Muslim." According to the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, and his successor, Ayatollah Khamenei, too, elections are very important. Imam Khomeini used to emphasize on the high status and role of elections and would persuade everybody to take part in all elections. The Imam would consider election as one of the honors of the Islamic Republic system. He said that election is a picture of freedom and independence of the country. He made it clear several times that no one, including the ulema and the elite, is entitled to impose their view on people, and it is people who have the right to shape their fate. In view of this, the Imam said, "We have no right. God the Exalted has not granted us the right. The Prophet of Islam has not given us the right to impose anything upon our nation." Elsewhere, Imam Khomeini said, "The authority should be in people's hand. This is a rational issue. Every wise person accepts this issue, that the ordainments of everyone should be in his own hand." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also puts high emphasis on elections. He said, "The prime importance of election is because election is the trench of country. People's presence at ballot boxes immunizes the fate of nation and people and prevents the enemy from invasion, aggression, and further impudence." The leader said nearly 20 years ago, "Our country relies on people's votes. The reason why the enemies of the nation and those who look avariciously at this land have failed to deal any harm to it is the presence, will, and participation of people in different scenes." In view of the leader, elections are among the faithful and sensitive arenas of the country. He calls elections as the night of Qadr of the Islamic system, since it determines the affairs of the country for 4 years. He says, "The republicanism and Islamism of the system both depend on election because materialization of republicanism and Islamism and the rule of people in the administration of the country has no way but holding of election." Ayatollah Khamenei says elsewhere, "Election is injection of fresh blood into the body of the Islamic Republic system. It is the renewal of power and force for the nation. Election means this. It means injecting a new spirit, a new blood, and a new breath into the country, into the nation, and into the people. This is election." We'll be right back.
Ayatollah Khamenei clarifies the election as follows. It is both a right and an obligation for people to come and determine the fate of their country carefully, as the country belongs to the people. People should come and, through correct and free election, determine the lawmakers in the legislature, determine their directors as it has been assigned in the law. This is the people's right and it belongs to them, but it is an obligation too. It is not that one says, I don't want to apply my right. No, the fate of the system depends on application and wielding of this right. This is an obligation. Everyone should participate. Election is both the right of nation and a national duty. The Islamic Republic system has annulled the systems which appoint power, and it granted the people's election a role in the administration of the country. This is the right of each person in the country to be able to elect and play a role in determining the manager of the country. Furthermore, it is a duty too, because this participation can keep alive the spirit of vividness and sense of responsibility in the society forever, and it can manifest people's presence boastfully in the face of the enemies of this nation. Election is not a mere duty. It is not a mere right either. It is both your right and a public duty. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the status of election, election per se is the symbol of national might. If the dear Iranian nation manages to bring its ample votes to the scene in this election, and the people's presence is spectacular, this will be the greatest symbol of might and national dignity. The leader maintains that broad participation in election will ensure the country, as he says, people's presence in election will ensure the country de facto. Election is the real indicator of people's presence in the country's political scene. Every election which is held fervently will ensure the country. In his recent remarks to the visiting people of East Azerbaijan province, Ayatollah Khamenei said, everyone should participate in the election. Election is the main basis of the Islamic Republic system. Election is the course of the country's reform. Those who intend to solve problems and to repair, they should come to election. The accurate way is to elect.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.